Et maintenant, c'est un grand plaisir de présenter Yvonne Rogers. Elle va parler en anglais. Elle va parler des systèmes collaboratifs avec les choses récentes. Elle est professeure à l'University College of London et je suis très fière de dire qu'elle vient d'être nommée avec le Lifetime Research Award pour SIGKAI, qui était la société savante pour interaction humaine-machine.
First of all, I'd like to thank Wendy for a wonderful presentation. It's really difficult to follow that. There's so many, it was such a rich overview of the area of how we've developed technologies to support collaboration, to support communication and coordination. And what struck me as I saw all of the many projects that Wendy and her teams have been involved in Europe and other places is just how much creativity and excitement there was in doing that research. And I remember the first time when I saw someone through video conferencing, and it was so exciting to see their face. And I suspect for many people who, the general public, when they first used Skype or FaceTime, it was just sheer excitement. But then it just wears off. You just get used to it, and it becomes, just mainstream, and you get used, it no longer has that same excitement. But I think what ran through all of the research that Wendy did is they're always really thinking about what next, how can we support, whether it's in a sort of artistic frame or in work or at home between different generations, how can we enable them to somehow connect? And I think that comes through very clearly through all those many projects. And I'd like to think that we will continue our research in this area to be thinking about what possibilities there are with all the new technologies that come along and to sort of keep that creative streak. So thank you very much. This is one of my early projects, which we were thinking very much about collaborative learning, and that's what I'm going to be starting off with. How can you bring back the excitement to learning? And we spent a lot of time thinking about how you can design technologies to allow students to learn together indoors and outdoors, and that's another project. But today, I will talk about some current use of technology in learning, and then I'm going to talk about what I'm calling collaborative reflection, how we can design technologies to reflect together on what it is that we're doing, and then a bit about collaborative working, and then finally for us to ponder over what's happening next in terms of, is the metaverse going to take over? Or is there something else beyond the metaverse? So during the pandemic, we all had to stay at home and we all had to adapt very quickly to learning from home. And some of the technology companies tried to design their technologies to somehow help. And you may remember the dream, which was Teams try to come up with a virtual classroom where it would look as if the students were just like this in a classroom. And as you can see here, they're all smiling and they're all interacting. If only that was the reality. I don't know about you, but for a good year or two, that's what I had, which was me, that's not me, but I would be showing my face, but everyone else would turn their cameras off. And so I would have to face 50 or so students all like this. And I would, plead with them, if they please put your hand up or ask me a question. I had no idea whether they were listening, whether they were still asleep. One time I got them into breakout rooms, and there were about 10 people still left, because they hadn't gone to their breakout rooms because they weren't actually there. So that was one way to decide whether or not they were there. But it was very hard, and I thought a lot about why is it that students are so used to TikTok and sort of filming themselves, but not when it comes to being in a classroom. And part of it is that they're very self-conscious. They don't want to show their face because, as we know, your face can just fill up the whole screen. And so you become larger than life, and that can be quite difficult if all the other students around are watching. Some students claim that they had poor connectivity, and others may have still been in bed in their pajamas, but it became the norm, and it was very difficult to break out of that. So occasionally you might get in the chat, some of the students would type in a question. You think, yeah, it's got a question, it's got a question. But it had become that. Unfortunately, it never became that. But students, you know, are resourceful, and they think a bit, you know, about how they're using technology. And they have quite different ideas about what they want and how to learn together. And we did a big survey at my university, UCL, during the pandemic to find out what sorts of things that they were doing and they were using and what kinds of environments they liked. They really didn't like GatherTown. They all tried it, but it was a bit, I don't know how many of you tried GatherTown, but it was a bit blocky and retro, and it felt like a sort of 70s video game, and it didn't really give them the sense of being together. What we discovered was what's called the gong bang. I don't know whether you've come across this, but it's a phenomenon that started in Korea. And gong bang stands for study with me. And it became very popular, not just with university students, but also school children during COVID-19. So what is this study with me? Well, it's watching other students studying is basically the idea behind it. Is that this student here would set up a camera and that would be projected onto him, and then that would just be streamed live for others to watch him studying. And you might think, why would you want to watch someone else studying? Well, here's one called Ruby Granger, and she was in the UK, and she had hundreds of thousands of followers. So I'll just show you. She sets up the clock, she looks at the camera, smiles. She might even make a cup of coffee. And she does this every week, makes one of these videos. Sometimes it's in real time. And that's it, she's just studying. And in this case, she's using her her tablet and writing notes. Other times she might be reading a book. And it'll go on for 8 hours sometimes even 12 hours if you really want the full stint of her. She might get up to go to the toilet occasionally. But why did this become so popular? And so we kind of did a bit of research thinking about this. And it seems that they love watching others study online because essentially it motivates them to get started. It's very difficult when you're studying at home to get started. You procrastinate, you feed the cat, you make another cup of coffee, you find any excuse. Whereas when you're coming into the university or classroom, you have to be there. It also, importantly, provides a social life running in the background. So there's a chat that goes on, and they will all, make comments, put emojis there and say, I hear you, and so on. And that prevents them from feeling alone. So it very much gives this sort of sense of connecting with others and being a community. So if someone posts a string of emojis, the others will also post emojis. And they all chime in and say how Ruby is helping them. It's as if they need someone like that. It's as if, they're missing the teacher in a way, or each, when they used to go to the library, they would always be the real library, the physical library, watching each other, and that helps them get started. You may, this is sort of a different generation, perhaps, to my generation, where we would just go to the library and study. But this became a huge phenomenon during COVID, and I think it's still very much there, helping students. So that was something that was interesting to discover. The other thing that we discovered was that we heard from Wendy various tools that have been developed to support video editing and writing together. But we discovered how many of you have used Miro? Quite a few of you. It's essentially a digital tool for collaborative online, in this case, learning, but it can be for working together. And what they've done is provide a number of shared creative tools. So you can use diagramming and flowcharts, mind mapping, and also virtual post-it notes. These are all provided, and video conferencing, and they're all integrated together in this shared canvas. And we found that we used it a lot in our teaching during the pandemic, and it gave the students a sense of being in a place together. And they didn't have to show their faces, they just had to have their cursors and maybe their names, and that was enough. That they could feel comfortable with that. And they all worked simultaneously on the same canvas, so you could have up to 50 or 60 students working together. And they had this great awareness of each other's activities, and that was important to facilitate their learning. So one of my colleagues, Nick Marquardt, he used it very extensively in his work. And the course he was teaching on was interaction design. And so what he does is he gets each student to create a poster about a particular design interface that they've found problematic and why they find it problematic. And then they all place their posters up on the mirror boards side by side. They can see the previous year's example, so they can have a look at what someone else has done. So they get a sense of what everyone else is doing at the same time. So that's to start off with. And then we ask them to use the virtual post-it notes to comment on each other's posters. The yellow ones are the students, and the orange ones are the teaching assistants and the professor. They absolutely loved being able to make comments. We did teach them the art of commenting, constructive criticism, because it's important that they don't say rude things to each other, and also to read what others had said. And they found that really valuable to give feedback and to receive feedback in this way, and to be able to go around to everyone's projects on the board. So I think that's an example of a commercial product that was highly successful and has been used extensively in ways that we hadn't predicted. And we probably will continue to use it in the face-to-face once we return, because it gives something new, something extra. So that's just a flavour of how students and ourselves have adapted to using what's out there. But I think, like Wendy, I'm very interested in how we can think about new technologies that we can create ourselves to support and facilitate collaborative learning. So now COVID-19 is almost, well, I wouldn't say over, but we have, you know, started returns to schools and to universities. How do we get them to work together again in person? And I'm very interested in face-to-face learning and collaborative learning and designing technology to support that. Just before COVID, I was involved in a project which was thinking about how we could use dance, this may sound strange, to teach students about number systems. How could we combine computer science with dance? And it was a collaboration between ourselves at UCL in the computer science department, a choreographer and a computer science educator, and people from Wayne McGregor studio, to think differently about how you can get a class of students to learn together. We didn't want them to just teach them about coding, because there's an awful lot already out there that you can use to help students code. This was about all the other boring bits of computer science that you have to teach them. And number systems is one which they learn, but they don't really enjoy. So what we wanted to do, and what we did do rather, is we developed an in-person workshop which should last for half a day, and it was going to be an immersive digital dance experience for 12 to 14-year-olds. We picked that age because they're a bit awkward, but they still have a bit of childlikeness to them that they'll participate. And they've also learnt about number systems, so we wanted to get them to revisit and think of it differently. But we wanted to get them to think about binary and ASCII, and also think about data visualization. So combining a bit of exciting stuff about computer science with the boring stuff with dance. So really kind of thinking differently out of the box of how you can get students to experience together and have a playful learning experience. So I'm going to let this video show you what we did.
Thank you. Movement in a responsive way. So for that, we built these wearables. This one has a battery, a charger, and all the other necessary components inside. So that means we could actually visualize body movement in space. So since this one's only capable of displaying a movement in a single location, we use these base stations that have 8 time-of-flight sensors. The range of these sensors is 4 meters. That means if this is put on the floor, we have a diameter of 8 meters that people could stand around. And then we can visualize sound, different visuals, and how people just traverse space overall.
Working with Sue, I think we're going to combine movement and this physical computing tool to create a workshop. And the workshop's going to be based around data visualization, binary, and data representation for key stage 3 students. We're going to further develop that workshop with Studio Wayne McGregor and Suzanne from UCL. And then we're going to be delivering that in December to students. Yes. We hope the outcomes are an increased ability to understand these key stage 3 concepts, to learn and embed what are sometimes very abstract concepts and sometimes very things that are very tough to wrap your head around. But hopefully through the movement and through these tools, we're able to kind of create some more ways in.
Key stage 3 is the part where students will be making decisions about their next steps in their education, and a lot of the time they feel that computing isn't something that's relevant to them or interesting to them, and hopefully presenting it in a completely different way will show them that actually it can be really creative, it can inform decisions about what they might do in other areas of their interests, sports, drama, music, choreography, art, all sorts of areas. So it connects in really nicely with all sorts of things. I think it's also important to say that if dance will help more girls be interested in computing, then perhaps computing with dance will help more boys be interested in dance.
It's very interesting, it's very intellectual, and I like the fact that it crosses over with technology, because it shows people that dance isn't just about the dancing, it also connects into lots of other areas and subject areas.
I'll stop there. It was a joy to do that project. We managed to get into schools, 3 schools just before the lockdown came, but we're now resuming and to return to that. But I think one of the things was to think about, you know, we have the curriculum, we have to teach computer science, but how can we turn students on to be excited, to be creative, to think differently? And so as you saw in the video, we came up with some quite new technologies, and the idea was that these would just be used for part to inspire the students to explore, but they would also be taught about number systems in conventional ways, but also using a whole range of materials. So not to think about the computer as being the only thing to learn through, but to be one of many. And so these wearable devices, you could see, you could draw on a screen using limb movements, leg or arm, And they could learn the difference between 1-bit, 2-bit, 4-bit, and 8-bit. So they could switch on and just have the 1-bit, and it showed it was just in monochrome. If they switched to the 2-bit, they could see that it would have these lines of colour, but they were quite, you know, disjunct. Whereas in 4 and 8, you get them much smoother and more colours. So they were able to explore what the difference is using these wearables. And the same with the other device we created, which was a base station that had sensors that could track the lower body movements. And you saw that you could move in and out. And we gave different visualizations for those, so they could be open-ended visualization that was continuous. You could either be on or off, and you could have these different colors. And then you could switch to a different mode, which was to explore bits. You could either be 1 or 0. So we had lots of different apps that they could explore using these different tools. And I just wanted to reiterate that they were just there to help them think about number systems and to explore. But the key was to think about the whole workshop, which was half a day, and how you spliced it up to maintain interest and to get them to be able to explore and think about the different technologies in their small groups. And then at the end, as a large group. It was an absolute joy to see those who might be interested in computer science more to actually get into dance, and those who were into dance to actually explore computer concepts. We didn't stop there, though. We got really carried away with what we could do with tangible devices. And we developed this box, which is an evaluation device called EvalMe. So when kids finish something, they all have to fill in a questionnaire, and they all just think, oh, I don't want to do this, and they just do the tick boxes and the Likert scales, and they don't really think much about it. So we thought, how could we make this part enjoyable as well? So this device allows them, using these dials here, to express their answers to a range of questions. And these questions you can change by putting on a different template. And so periodically through the workshop, we handed out this box for them to record their responses, and they could just move this dial upwards and backwards, and the LEDs around would light up. And what we found was that, yes, they could do it by themselves, but they actually enjoyed doing it together and talking to each other about which aspects of the workshop they enjoyed and why they did that. So we wanted to make it more of a reflective process rather than just getting data so that you could say they really enjoyed this, they learnt a lot. We did get that data. You can see, how many people have given this score. And we thought, if we present it back to the students whilst they're sitting there, will they say anything? So we presented it back to them, complete blank faces. They didn't want to put their hand up. Again, it's that being a bit self-conscious about being able to say something. So that part didn't actually work, but they enjoyed actually doing the act of evaluating what we'd built. So I think you can see that I'm really excited by tangible interfaces. And a few years ago, we did something called the VoxBox. And this, again, was trying to make something more public, more open, rather than it being something you give your feedback about some event or about your opinions about something. So we designed what we call the VoxBox, which you can see here. It's all about tangible physical interface, whereby you can see how many questions you need to answer, what those questions are, and that you go through these different modules. And then there is a feedback that shows what everyone has been saying and responding to. So the inspiration for this, if you like, physical machine that asks questions, was we went to various science museums and looked at how old digital physical devices had been built, and looking at all the levers and buttons and so on. And that was very much behind the design of this. And so having these physical knobs, so this one was, how connected do you feel to the crowd? Including an old-fashioned telephone, which surprisingly, all the young children seem to know what to do with it, even though they may not have one in the home. And then real-time infographics, showing what percentage of people had answered the questions. And we found, we put it into various places. It was exhibitions and festivals. And what we found was there were queues of people wanting to have a go on it, wanting to give us their feedback. And it wasn't just individuals, it was families, there's people on bikes and wheelchairs and so on. And you got families, you know, trying to do it together. And it was a very different experience for having it like this than just someone coming up to you with a clipboard. I'll just show you a quick...
One final question. What will you most remember about this event? Please say your answer, then hang up and press the submit button.
Very hot with lots of food.
So you can see the pleasure people had in giving us feedback. And we had a lot of interest from commercial companies wanting to get one of these to put into their office. But unfortunately, with tangible interfaces and physical computing, it's very expensive to try and commercialize or to develop these into some sort of prototype. So we did explore for about 6 months, and then we decided we just didn't have the wherewithal or the backing to do that, which is a great shame. So I hope I've shown you in this first part how you can continue to bring the joy into learning, particularly collaborative learning, but also thinking about how you assess it through this sort of more public and collaborative way using these types of interfaces. I'm going to now move on to think about other technologies that have been around for a while and that we've been looking at as a way to facilitate collaborative working. So we saw Wendy showing various projects and technologies that have been developed to promote collaborative working, particularly when you're working on the same document. Well, here we were thinking differently to think about how you can facilitate people who are working in the same room using technology. And you might be familiar with how smart speakers are beginning to be used to coordinate business meetings. So this one here, Alexa is being used to schedule meetings and take minutes and provide notifications and reminders. But that's fairly limited in what it's being used for. What if they could do more? What if we could use chatbots and agents to facilitate our face-to-face meetings and become our collaborators? How would we design them? How would we design them to be proactive, that they would intervene? And we need to think about what role could they play. Would they be like a moderator, a teacher, a facilitator, or what? And what we want to do is not to make them be too interventionist, that they become like Clippy. I don't know if you remember Clippy, where Clippy would appear on your display and it would say, "I think you're writing a letter, can I help you?" And it got so annoying. So what we were very conscious of was to think about how we might design these chatbots to intervene where it seems appropriate and helpful, not because they can do. And the project that we worked on was, again, very much grounded in a real-world need. We worked with people in a children's hospital in London called Great Ormond Street Hospital, and they get lots and lots of data now, and they can use AI to classify the data, but they need to be able to interpret the data, particularly health data when it's complex. And so they were very interested in how we might help them to make sense of data visualizations that they are now getting, but perhaps don't have the time or the wherewithal to make sense of. So we were thinking, well, maybe agents could be developed to help them think about what's going on in that data. Why is it that that graph's gone down there? Why is it that it's close there? What is it that's causing these differences and peaks and troughs? And so we developed Visy not to try and do this on their behalf, but to try and guide them where to look. They should be looking over here, maybe, and to facilitate the sense-making amongst them in the team. So what we wanted to do was to design these chatbots to make humans think more rather than the chatbots do the thinking themselves, because we're trying to encourage them within the teams to do this kind of sense-making. So Visy was designed to prompt teams to hypothesize about a set of obesity data. And we chose that because it was publicly available and there's a lot of it around and it's a real problem. And we chose Visy to intervene when it appeared that a team was stuck. And that would be when they hadn't said anything or they kept saying the same thing. And it does this by asking open-ended questions such as, do you need a hint for analyzing X? What do you think of this? Shall we move on? Did you consider the difference between variable X and Y? And what might have caused the sudden spike? So they would have these types of visualizations for different variables. It could be gender, it could be developing or developing countries, or it could be between girls and boys or women and girls. And for each comparison, there's a difference between the way in which obesity increases or stays the same. And so we wanted them to think about why is that over the last 30 years. So like many others in human-computer interaction, we didn't want to build our AI system, which takes for quite a considerable amount of time, before we knew whether we'd got Visy to be at the right level. So we used the Wizard of Oz method. And the Wizard of Oz method, for those who are not familiar, is to have a human being, and this is our human being, Ethan, pretending to be the agent, and being able to make the interventions as and when it was seemed appropriate. And so he had a list of potential interventions, and then he had some criteria for different settings. And for this one, it was if a team hadn't discussed a pattern or trend in the data that was being referred to, and there was a silence in the conversation for at least 3 seconds. And so he practiced this before we ran our experiments. So we did a number of experiments, but I'm just going to talk, and we looked at different interfaces, whether it's voice, whether it's chatbot, but I'm just going to talk about how having an agent like this facilitated how the teams collaborated. And you can see the setup we had, which was a shared display, and in the middle there, we have the voice assistant, and then they could ask Visy to change the visualization, and Visy could make the suggestions about what they might do next or what they might look at next. So I'm going to just summarize the findings rather than go through all experimental setup. It's just been published in Tokai, so if you're interested, you can go and read it. But we found that it encouraged the teams to generate more hypotheses about obesity trends when they had Visy intervening with these prompts. And it got them to focus on the causes behind the different way the lines increased or decreased in the graphs. And here's one quote. I like that the questions were on finding out more about the data. By answering the questions, or even by looking at it, you would think about the consequences. And then you would ask yourself, why is this line more steady than the other, which wouldn't necessarily happen without the assistant. So I think the assistant is prompting and probing them to think more deeply. And here's an example of a conversation after a Visy prompt, which is Visy, there's a silence of 3.5 seconds, and then Visy says, what might have caused the sudden spike? And the data is referring to the visualization on the right, and this is the spike here. And it says, these are two participants in this particular study. Is it globalization? Possibility of getting a lot of different foods, or could also be, obviously electronics, PlayStations. Children play less outside and get overweight. Yeah, but it's actually quite surprising. Then they go into more specific detail here about what the rise is. Yes, even a bit more. People stay less outside and play inside. Look, the other one is just linear, so they're comparing it with one, the developing versus the developed countries. And then they say, perhaps we should look at the graph for men and boys to see if it's the same for them as well. So you can see how this one prompt here triggered this quite extended conversation that then led them to look at another visualization. And that's what we found, was that they were looking at different visualizations more after being prompted. So, what I've just shown you in that one study there is that we think we can design virtual agents not just to be there as a front for a Q&A, which is how you see them now, but to enhance human-human communication and collaboration. And I think that's just as important to be thinking about, especially guiding their ideation and sense-making. Whether or not they could support remote working is another matter, and I'll leave that for Wendy to think about how we might use agents in that context. But I think with any research, if it then leads you to thinking about a different question, that's always a good outcome. And what it led us to think about is whether slowing down how we think when we design technology is a good idea. And we think it is, because it triggers different trains of thought. If you're always rushing and trying to get something done, that's about completion, getting things done. But we found that if you push people and prompt them with this, it makes them sit back and think and perhaps have a different line of thought and come up with a different reason. And so we're thinking about how can we design software that's geared towards slowing people down rather than speeding them up. Nearly every software has been designed to speed people up. You can have filters, you click, 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 and it's all about getting things done, whereas we're thinking of the opposite. So that's what one of our next projects is to think about what does it mean to slow people down and why would you want to do it? And we have so much technology out there to experiment with and design with. I've talked a bit about what we've done with tangibles and physical computing. I haven't really touched on mobile and ubiquitous computing, but we did a lot with that. We've worked with software tools, and I talked about speech and robots and chatbots. AI is another area which is, there's a lot there we can think about how we might design to support collaboration. But I want to finish off with the metaverse, because everyone's talking about it. Everyone has an opinion about the metaverse. And it's not just Facebook, or should I say Meta, who have been, very much investing in it. But many companies are also trying to get in on the act, and they're thinking about the infrastructure. But the metaverse, essentially, as you can see here, the idea is that you have your avatar, and you can connect with others in this virtual world, and as you can see here, have a great time. You can socialize, you can interact. This is one of the early versions where they didn't think you needed a lower half. You just need to be here, show you, and you can move around without legs. I think it's perhaps some people would say, how is it different from Second Life that came out 20 years ago? And we were just talking at the beginning, where I think here for the younger generations, putting on a VR headset is second nature in many ways. And they can immerse themselves for many hours in these types of worlds, such that it can be quite difficult when they come out of that into the real world to adjust. So I think it's exciting times. There are many people who are claiming it's the next big thing, and that we will have these data-rich experiences and services. And we can have business meetings and social events as if they are just like we remember them. And there's talk about it not being just for making money, but I'd read an article last week about what would it mean to have an open metaverse where it could be community-owned and community-governed, and that's the opposite of what perhaps Microsoft and Meta are trying to do. But I leave you with thinking about how different will it be for people entering these worlds from those who experienced in Second Life, and this is Second Life over here. And what is it about creating these sort of 3D worlds that makes us want to enter them and interact and socialize in them? But I think this is the future. And I'm going to finish with looking at a technology that was developed using holograms in the last 2 or 3 years. It's a BBC documentary about Portal. I don't know if any of you have heard of Portal, and what they're planning to do with it.
Los Angeles, the place where anything is possible. Even the weird stuff that I've gone up to here over the years.
What am I doing over there, though? What's he doing?
In early 2020, pretty much the last thing I filmed outside of the UK, just before we were all locked inside our homes, was Portal in Los Angeles.
Spoiler alert! I'm not ready in the box! I'm out here!
Not quite a hologram, but so remarkably lifelike that it really impressed me. It was a backlit cubicle and a large transparent LCD screen, which really made it look like there was someone in the box. Exactly 2 years on, I'm finally back in LA, and I wanted to catch up with David Nussbaum to see what's happened to his idea.
How have you been? Looks like you're doing okay.
We're doing all right.
How has the pandemic affected the course that Portal took?
Well, I thought that we were going to be doing a lot of permanent installations a couple of years ago. I was talking about portals being permanently installed in movie theater lobbies and hotel. Everything shut down right after I said that. So what we did was, when everything shut down, we focused on live beaming. If you can't be there, beam there.
There are now more than 200 portals around the world, and as long as you have a connection of 15 to 20 megabits per second, you can talk back to the person in the box. Yeah, it's more expensive than a Zoom call, but of course, it's more eye-catching too. And that's why they're also being used for advertising, with some shopping malls streaming 4K animations and video from the cloud.
The window of the future, if you're walking into a retail location, might look something like this.
I cannot listen to you at the moment because in my peripheral vision, there is a lion walking towards me on a travelator.
A CGI lion.
Now, last time I was here, I was beamed into the portal using a very expensive 4K camera and a lot of cables. But as I said before, technology only moves in one direction. So now, would you believe I'm being filmed on a phone and sent wirelessly into the portal? Now, there is a bit of a delay, admittedly, but apart from that, I'm in the box.
TikTok stars, Instagrammers, YouTubers, they're the movie stars of today. And I said, well, if they're creating content on their phones right now, I want them to be able to create content for our devices on their phones. So we've developed an app that goes on any smartphone that allows people to remove the camera and start using their phones.
What's really interesting is that once you've cracked the main problem, you can start drawing on other ideas and plugging into other existing technologies. So of course this is going to start talking to Snapchat, and of course you're going to be able to turn me into Iron Man or Mr. Cartoon Face or I don't know, whatever you want really. What are they doing to me?
And while I make an ass of myself, here's the next portal. It's not life size, it's desktop size. Now, there are no working prototypes yet. These are CG simulations, but there are also no real technological barriers preventing them from being built.
Picture, a virtual assistant. So we're putting a face to Alexa. We can also display your NFTs and all of your digital artwork. I can see architects using this as a way to display the structures that they're working on. You could zoom in, it's touchscreen, it's voice activated, so you can move it around and manipulate it. I see little Sally talking to grandma from across the pond as a way of full interaction, right?
I wonder what another pioneer of the moving image, James Cameron, would make of all this.
Well, in the meantime, that's it from us from Los Angeles for this week. Don't forget, we live on social media, on Facebook.
So it's interesting to think about this portal becoming something that could be, a desk size, a bit like replacing your PC, where you can actually have a 3D hologram of someone you're talking to. And is that something that we would want? Is it something that, and I think that's what I would like to conclude on, is that we are constantly developing technologies to enhance the experience, the social presence, if you like. So seeing something in 3D that seems like it's real, like the lion or like your granny, is that going to be something that stays with us? Is it going to help us to communicate? Or is it enough just to have our granny in, on your smartphone? I think it's interesting to look at some of the literature that's been written about social presence. And one of the earliest is by a social psychologist, Short, and their colleagues. And they talk a lot about how might we measure and try and assess the sense of being there with a real person. And so the indices that they've used and talked about are this sense of the degree of awareness, the sense of feeling and reaction to other people in these virtual worlds. And if you're aware of someone versus how, you know, as if they're close to you, the proximity. So I'm not going to, we're coming to the end here, but I think it's interesting to think about whether these types of measures that have been around will help us to see whether the likes of Metaverse and Portal do create that social presence, or whether we need new conceptual frameworks. And my view is that I think these were good at the time, thinking about telecommunication, but they really don't, they fall short, no pun intended, of thinking about these new, rich experiences that we're creating in holograms and 3D. And we need some good PhD students out there to come up with new measures and ways of understanding social presence. So on that note, I'd like to thank you all for being a good audience. 2 hours almost is a long time to be sitting here, and also all of my colleagues who've worked with me. So thank you very much.